Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. This is Kim Brown and Nancy Rowe, and we're the Liver Lineup Updates and Unfiltered Insights. We're going to be talking today about AASLD 2025, and in the beginning, we're going to discuss some issues related to transplant. Kim, why don't you launch us on this interesting topic?
Yeah, thanks, Nancy. There was not a lot new about transplantation, but I did select a couple of things that I thought were a bit of a game changer. I like to choose those things, you know, things that might change our clinical practice. So the first one was really looking at how we assess frailty. We recognize that frailty in the past, I think we've always used our eyeballs and said, you know, too sick or too frail for transplant. And people have tried to standardize that in large part because we recognize that patients who move into transplant who are frail have increased risk of morbidity, mortality. So how best to measure that? So there have been indexes that have been developed, the Liver Frailty Index in particular, and we have implemented that at our institution, but it is somewhat time-consuming and requires additional medical assistant time. So this was a study looking at the six-minute walk, which is a pretty easy test to assess patients, and looked at how that compared with the Liver Frailty Index in predicting post-transplant mortality. There were 298 patients. The majority of them had the six-minute walk test, and 82 had the Liver Frailty Index. And they defined both in terms of frail, pre-fail, and robust. And then looked really at the pre-transplant outcomes, waitlist deaths, or patients who were denied. And there were really no differences if you looked at the categories for either. And then when you looked at post-transplant outcomes, there were really no differences in ICU stay, the total hospital stay, readmission. There was a little bit higher graft loss in the Liver Frailty Index group, but post-transplant deaths were similar. So I think really the bottom line of this was that it is important for us to be assessing this in as part of the transplant evaluation, but how to do this in an easy way as we see patients, this does appear to be similar and a pretty easy thing, I think, to implement in our own clinics. So I don't know. Do you test for frailty in your institution? Is it recorded anywhere?
Yeah, every listed or evaluated patient has a form of frailty score assessed at each and every visit, and we document that. I don't know that we use it to deny anyone transplant, but we and we don't have a preconditioning clinic. You might have that. I know a lot of institutions do, but we do take those individuals that are flagged as frail and, you know, encourage them to engage in physical therapy or use that measure to keep a little bit more close of an eye on them. Those frail patients tend to come back to clinic more often, probably more interventions with the nutritional service and, you know, more assessments for frailty because you're just coming into clinic more frequently. And I think it's really important. You're right, though. It does take a medical assistant or at least a person to be able to do that hand grip strength and those measures. And, you know, when you're doing something repeatedly but not necessarily using it as an actionable item, you know, I think we have to make sure that it is of value. You know, I also clinically still think that the eyeball test is a valid test. Not to say that it's not a perfect one, but we all have patients who, you know, come in, can barely get onto the examination table. I don't know that they need a formal frailty assessment to be determined that they are frail. My question to you is, where do you do that 6-minute walk? I have to traverse from one side of my hospital to the other often in 6 minutes. And so I don't want my patients to run away from clinic. Where did they do this?
So, this is commonly used, right, in our pulmonary clinics and has been for a long time. And it's really just marked up in the hallway. So people don't take a continuous 6-minute walk. It is a back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, you know, up and down the hallway. But But I think, and we certainly have a long enough hallway that we can do that for patients and look at that measurement, see how far they make it. But again, somebody has to observe, right? Somebody has to start them and do the observation. But a little bit easier, I think. We found really hand grip strength. It was very difficult to find somebody who could consistently do that within a clinic visit. So the next one, I think, was one of the ones that really caught most people's attention. And this was looking at MELD 3.0. And as we know, we've redefined MELD continuously over time, adding serum sodium. And then people have looked at a multitude of things that disadvantage or advantage patients within the MELD system, one of which is sex, in large part because serum creatinine is used as part of the MELD. And we recognize that muscle mass is lower in female recipients than in males, and they may be disadvantaged in terms of their score. So this was looked at in a prospective way and was implemented as MELD 3.0, and we've been using this, obviously. And this was really looking at OPTN data of adult candidates from 2020 to 2024. So there were over 60,000 liver transplant candidates during that time. 40% of those were women. And the primary outcomes that they were looking at was really transplant access. So a recipient of one of the top five organ offers and the probability of undergoing deceased donor liver transplant. So I'll stop here for a second and just caution us, because really, as we all know, MELD is really a predictor of mortality, not organ offer. And so, you know, just take that into consideration. But so what they looked at was really three time periods. There was the previous period, obviously, when prior to implementation. Then there was the phase where they called it the burn-in phase, where they were starting to implement MELD 3.0, and then the subsequent period. And what they found, you can see on the left, so during the period of burn-in, there was a significant increase in the top five offer rates for women versus men, and the transplant rate increased over that time as well. Unfortunately, as time went on, though, the odds ratio actually went back to what was seen previous. And again, what these authors found, and this is probably true because this was looked at as well in the Liver and Intestine Committee, is that it may have more to do with size, which is height, as opposed to just whether you are a woman or a man. We recognize that short stature individuals are equally disadvantaged. So this was a little disappointing to see that MELD 3.0 didn't consistently sustain the increased relative number of offers to women. But again, really, I didn't see mortality, death on the waiting list, which is really, I think, what MELD is looking at. So I don't know what your thoughts were about this, Nancy.
Well, the first thing I thought, and maybe I missed it, is that did they exclude everyone that had exception points? Because, you know, exception points are going to be independent of MELD.
Yeah, no, I think they did. I have to think back, but I do think that they did exclude patients who had exception points.
And I know that in our own institution, we often find, you know, size is a big limitation. It's much easier to put an organ into a large person than it is to a tiny person. And women tend to be tinier. And I think it is height, but a lot of it is just, we have some really tiny little women that are just, you know, their chest, their abdomen, everything is just so small. And we will occasionally have a very small man. And those patients are difficult to transplant. I know our surgeons will pass over offers because they just don't fit into the individual. And, you know, I think that that is a big challenge.
Yeah, no, it is. So I don't know that, you know, we continue to improve MELD. I guess we just need to, there's a lot of things, right, that that probably advantage or disadvantage patients, age being one of them, height being one of them, but we'll, I guess, continue to look at this over time.
And I think the most important thing is that we are still evolving. So you want to have a dynamic score given the significant changes that are occurring in the indications as well as the patient populations that we consider for transplant.
Yeah, no, that's true. The next thing that we looked at were on the HCC side was looking at immunotherapy. We recognize, I think, that immunotherapy has become part of the mainstay for HCC treatment in our pre-transplant population. And there have been a number of single-center reports looking at the risk, obviously the risk of rejection and graft loss in these patients. So this was a retrospective study. It was quite a large study. It was a worldwide study of over 70 centers, and they collected data on HCC cases in those patients treated with checkpoint inhibitors. And really what they were looking at was downstaging or bridging before liver transplant. And then the outcomes really were recurrence and survival and acute rejection. And so there were quite a few patients. Most of them were Child's Pugh A, over 400 patients. Mean alpha-fetoprotein protein was 53, and about 23% were within Milan. Most of them received a PD-1 prior to transplant. About 25% got a PD-L1, and 6% got combined. And the median washout was 73 days. So what the authors found was that tumor size did decrease from an average of 5.5 centimeters to 3.8 prior to transplant, as did the number of total tumors. Very important, I think, was that at the start of immune therapy, 23% were within Milan, 43% at the end of liver transplantation, and alpha-fetoprotein declined. And what these authors found was that the major factor that determined recurrence was the response to the immune checkpoint inhibitor prior to transplant. Rejection rates were higher in the patients who received immune checkpoint inhibitors, but importantly, it was related in large part to the median washout time, but very acceptable outcomes. So I think, I don't think we have a strategy that is uniform across the world as to how to utilize these, but I think it is encouraging data to identify how we can bring more patients to transplant safely. Recognizing that that we have to be cautious in terms of the timing of transplant once these therapies are discontinued. Are these are you utilizing checkpoint inhibitors? I know you probably are in your cancer population, but what are your thoughts about taking patients to transplant once they've received these? Or
yeah. I think that the first is that the number of patients that are effectively downsized that we use an immune checkpoint inhibitor on are relatively small. Most of our downsizing occurs through local regional therapy, and that's a much more understandable bridge to transplant. And I think by the time we engage someone on immunotherapy, they either have systemic disease at the onset or they have something that is a very aggressive cancer that has not responded to local regional treatment. So we don't have too many IO patients that we would actually consider for transplant. So I can't remember a patient that we bridged with IO and that became a liver transplant recipient. We have a lot more post-transplant recurrence that we contemplate immunotherapy on, worried about risk of rejection versus tumor progression. But I think that globally, and especially knowing that some of the data that suggested that you could get more benefit from local regional treatment if you paired it with a tail of IO, independent of just trying to downsize someone who's got more systemic disease, we are going to see more patients exposed to immunotherapy that will fit within criteria to consider transplant. And knowing who of those are going to be good candidates and rejection. I mean, I'd love to know your opinion, Kim, but rejection isn't a death sentence. I mean, not to say that we ask for it, but, you know, there's a degree of rejection that we still get irrespective of immunotherapy. And those patients tend to not die of rejection.
Yeah. No, it's really, it is true. And, you know, we don't even in our patient population, you know, without liver disease, patients who are being treated in oncology, we actually rarely see those patients who develop immune-mediated hepatitis. Oncology just treats them. Right. So I do think that we have a number of therapies. You know, when you're looking at risk versus benefit, I think that even though rejection rates are higher, I agree with you, we do have pretty substantial ways to treat rejection. Other than chronic rejection, we really don't lose patients, you know, unless it's antibody mediated. I mean, those patients, we will lose grafts, but
there's always an exception.
Always an exception. The next abstract that I thought we'd just touch on briefly was to look at the hepatic steatosis and metabolic dysfunction on disease severity and treatment outcomes in HCC. I think we recognize now that metabolic disease is associated with increased risk of cancer in general. This was an abstract that looked at a prospective cohort of cancer patients and quantified steatosis based on MRI, PDFF, CAP, or biopsy. So it was a variety of things. They looked at their metabolic parameters, diabetes, obesity, hypertension, and then they looked at response based on LIRADS and RESIST. And what these authors found was that the first thing that they found was that higher steatosis was linked to more advanced stage disease. So in patients who were considered BCLCA, there was about anywhere from about 14% of patients who had more than 10% fat. In stage B, it was 36%. In stage C, it was 60%, which was significant. So the higher the fat content, the more advanced the disease appeared to be. And again, when they looked at overall treatment response, patients who had steatosis had somewhat of a worse response to patients who had less steatosis. And again, the authors found, at least in their cohort, that metabolic dysfunction and steatosis were associated with more advanced cancer and poor treatment response. So very interesting to think about, because the way I think about metabolic disease, almost as patients develop more advanced disease, the steatosis actually declines, you know, in these patients. So it's interesting to see, you know, are these patients, I don't know, the way I was thinking about this is, are patients, you know, with metabolic disease getting cancer, maybe at less fibrosis at an earlier stage, right? Because really, in our patients who are really burned out cirrhotics, you don't see a lot of fat in those patients. So, but I don't know, what do you think about this? Is this something that you feel is consistent with what we see clinically?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the big things I would take away from this in the beginning is that individuals who are identified through liver cancer surveillance are found at a much earlier time point. And individuals that present with symptomatic disease often have more advanced cancer. And I think a lot of our mast cell patients are unrecognized and probably not surveyed for liver cancer appropriately. Plus, I think one of the interesting debates at last year's AASLD was actually how and who do you screen with mast cell? So these individuals, even if flagged as appropriate for screening, ultrasonography is probably less accurate. They might get cancer, as you said, at non-cirrhotic stages, and there's just so many of them that it's easy to see that you might break down in a care cascade and identify patients later. I also think that mast cell patients may not understand, they got a lot on their plate with all their metabolic risk factors, and maybe the screening just doesn't occur at regular intervals to the same degree as it would in someone who's got, another indication for their liver disease.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. In fact, there was, and I just one other one that I wanted to go over, which was looking at adherence to surveillance, to your point. So there was a very nice abstract at the meeting looking at adherence to surveillance, prevalence and reasons for that. This was a 3-year prospective cohort of adults with cirrhosis. They excluded people who had liver lesions pre-existing or data that was incomplete. And then they looked at the adherence to a screening protocol and tried to obtain reasons for non-adherence. And, what the authors found was that full adherence was, which included for them an L-theta protein and an ultrasound every 6 months, was less than 10%. Okay. And partial adherence, meaning ultrasound only, which I think many people may think is the adequate one, was still less than 50%. And what the authors found was that when they looked at the reasons for non-adherence, again, these were patient reported, about 26% said that it wasn't advised by their treating physician. So it wasn't recommended that they undergo this. But a significant percentage of patients had financial constraints or it was remote. They had no access. They felt better, so they didn't follow up, et cetera. So there were a number of reasons that actually patients didn't comply with their screening, but the biggest one was that it wasn't recommended by their doctor. And so I think this is, and we recognize the clear association between screening and identification of tumors at an earlier stage. So this is really disappointing, I think. And to your point, talking about the patient with metabolic disease, perhaps the biggest reason is their doctor doesn't perceive it as a risk.
Yeah, it's interesting. They didn't report how many individuals got alpha-fetoprotein alone because, there are two ways that patients are inconvenienced. The first is they don't want to get a blood test. And so lots of times when I see a patient who's been to their primary care provider and they've had a CBC and lipids and all the labs, but they didn't get an AFP, I might only do the ultrasound and then send a letter that says the next time this person gets blood, they need an alpha-fetoprotein. And then other patients just don't want an ultrasound or, I send angry messages to our radiologist about I need that VIS score. I need to know if this ultrasound was a valid ultrasound. And I think patients sometimes feel the back and forth. They get an ultrasound done and the report says dense, study, please get an MRI. And then I'm like, well, the radiologist couldn't really see much. And to do that every 6 months, I think they get fatigued and they don't want to adhere to that schedule. Also, our guidelines changed, right? Alpha-fetoprotein has been a tug of war. And so I think that it is hard to call full adherence AFP and ultrasound unless you actually are sure that you have a clinician that is aware that our new guidance changed to now re-include AFP.
It's interesting. There just as a last point of discussion, the biggest reason was that patients weren't advised to do it. Okay. But right. Clearly the second one was lack of resources. They couldn't, get to where they needed to go. People have looked at blood-based testing, right? It's much easier for a patient to go to a Quest or a Ward or someplace close by and get a blood test as opposed to scheduling an ultrasound or some kind of imaging study. And as there were a number of things at the liver meeting regarding new testing, blood-based screening for cancer. The last abstract I'll talk about was one that just looked at comparing AFP, AFPL3, DCP, and other composite scoring models, because, again, there are a number of models that are being used now. And what they found was that GALAD, ASAP, GAP, which are all, you know, composite scores, outperformed individual markers, which would include our individual marker of AFP alone, right? And that, at least in this study, GALAD offered the most consistent diagnostic accuracy across different cutoff points in patients with HCC. So again, I think the whole point of this is making it easier, making it more consistent, trying to get to a point where we can do something simply for a patient and try to screen them. But I think ultrasound, we're kind of moving away from that, right? And more toward composite scores, blood bank, blood-based markers. Do you?
I agree.
Do you use, for example, AFPL3? Do you use these? These were developed years ago, right? And just never kind of came into vogue until more recently.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've had alpha fetoprotein L3 as a resource for a long time, but I have to admit that I only order it in patients who have elevated AFP. I just don't know what to do if my L3% is high, but my total AFP is 2. You know, so I know that that's not the algorithm, and that's certainly not how GALAD was developed, but that's often how I use the L3. And then the DCP, I think a lot of data suggested that it was elevated in individuals who had tumor thrombus in their portal vein, although that's not the only use. But because we have to order, there are some places where you can get this as a panel. And then there's other tools that are in development that probably use these. But in our own lab, I have to order each individually. And I think I definitely do not order DCP as often as I order the L3, which is generally a trigger because my AFP is elevated. And I want to know if how much of it is the L3%. And if my AFP is 9,000, I don't need the L3. We've got a problem. It's those individuals have AFP of like 22 or, you know, 12, and it's above the normal, but you are a little worried. Is it a marker of inflammation or hepatocyte regrowth, or is it really cancer that I just didn't see? And I don't know about you, but if my AFP is elevated, I'm always going to get cross-sectional imaging.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think I'm starting to use it more just to try to trigger who do I image. Would I choose an ultrasound or cross-sectional imaging based on my, you know, degree of suspicion? Oftentimes just with AFP alone, I find that a rising AFP is much more helpful to me than the absolute number. And so, you know, watching that, you know, getting an abnormal study, doing an ultrasound, seeing what it looks like next, you know, it depends on my degree of suspicion. Yeah, I think that we are moving more and more toward blood-based testing for a lot of different things in our field, but also in the entire field of cancer, right?
Absolutely. And it's easier for patients. And I think we learn a lot with more information. It may not be something you act on today, but when we put all of that and look backwards to see what patients developed cancer and, you know, what algorithms are more efficient, that's really impactful. I mean, I don't know about you, Kim, but I look at those guidelines every time we go over ultrasound surveillance as, you know, a group, like talking to the fellows and residents, and it says, oh, you have a small abnormal mass on your ultrasound, wait and get another ultrasound. I mean, none of us do that. No patient is going to be like, oh, I might have a cancer. It's tiny. I'm just going to wait for another ultrasound. It always triggers cross-sectional imaging, at least in our hands, even though that's not what the guidelines say. And so I think that having a way of moving to less reactionary testing and more proactive, logical assessment that allows your clinician and your patient to feel comfortable that you're not going to miss something at a time where it's curable is important.
No, I completely agree. And I think that again, I think our guidelines sometimes lag behind our clinical practice, right? And are related to the treatment options that we have at the time that the guidelines are written. We have so many opportunities now to treat early disease that finding early disease is really, you know, the point. And if you don't have a treatment, then finding it, it isn't really as helpful. So absolutely. I agree. You know, we use cross-sectional imaging and we find a lot of cancers, just as you do.
Now, this is not to say that Kim and I are anti-AASLD guidelines. We feel that these are very, very important.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. They are what we need to follow, but we also need to recognize that as our practice changes, the guidelines will change as well. And they have changed over time. To your point, we now do AFP in addition to ultrasound. So